Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1, listen to Talk with Marie Live. Get ready for some music, books, social events, and special guests. Here's your host, Marie.
Hello everyone, welcome to the show. You're listening to another episode of Talk with Marie Live on Blog Talk Radio. Today I have a wonderful guest who is a recent graduate from MSU. She earned her PhD recently, and she's going to be talking about her research, which was a case study on health, and she's going to tell you guys what that's all about. If you want to call in, the number is 718-664-9620. You can call me or us and ask us any question. My guest today is Louise Michelle Vital. I've never said your whole name before, Michelle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I don't ever usually use my full name either, but I'm learning to reclaim Louise. My mother always refers to me as Louise Michelle. So.
I know. Vital. Welcome to the show. So you're lucky you didn't have a middle name, Marie, because that could have been, you know, the other scenario. So. I'm excited to have you on. So the reason was really your dissertation. You wouldn't believe that I actually spent a good part of my weekend reading. This is how exciting my weekend gets. I read dissertation just for fun. And I've been waiting for yours forever.
I know. I'm sending it. Finally, I felt confident enough to send it along. So you read it, or almost finished, I think you said.
Oh, I'm still going through it. And so, well, I know also you're still sort of readjusting to being back to Boston after being in Michigan for a few years. How has that transition been?
Yeah, so I was away for 5 years, and I came back periodically, maybe 2 or 3 times a year. But even then, it was like for a weekend or maybe 4 days. And so being back, there are things that existed that didn't exist before, shopping locations and Trader Joe's and, you know, all these
neighborhoods.
There's a lot of Starbucks and Panera Breads that weren't here before. So I'm like, wow, there's a lot of revitalization happening. So
yeah, you missed the gentrification. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
So yeah, it's still happening.
There's that.
But yeah, it's been great to have you back. And then I think you missed a Simmons reunion. So let's tell our viewers, listeners, a little bit about you, because you started out in Boston and then you went to Michigan. Now you're back. So let's get a little background on your educational journey from Boston to Michigan and now back to Boston.
Okay. Well, I'll just say I attended parochial school from 3rd to 12th grade, and I was actually talking to my mom earlier today, and I told her all of my elementary schools no longer exist. They were either renamed or shut down. So I'll start with college, which is where you and I met, which was Simmons College, which was an undergraduate women's college, a great institution, a great place to be. And when I was there, I double majored in sociology and African-American studies, and I was a very active student leader and had a lot going on. So I loved my undergraduate experience. And then after that, I was like, well, what am I going to do with a sociology and African-American studies, you know, double major? But all the jobs I had while at Simmons were working with, you know, kids and teens in the neighborhood and doing tutoring and stuff. And so I actually got a job as an education director for the Boys and Girls Clubs of Dorchester. And I was an education director for 3 years. Yeah, it was so cool. It was such a great experience, and I think it was the best job that I've ever had still all these years later, because, well, for one, my hours were 1 to 9, so I could sleep in. But beyond that, the staff who worked there just really committed to the kids and the community. A lot of them been there 20, 25 years, 30 years. And it was just a great environment for me to develop as a new professional. And then I went to Michigan State, where I got my master's in student affairs. And then I graduated in 2005, and I went back to Simmons College. So I keep going back and forth between two schools. You're going to notice a theme here. So I went back to Simmons, and I worked there from 2005 to 2010 in student affairs. And that was really cool, being back at my undergraduate alma mater and working with young women and future, you know, leaders. And then I got this yearning to kind of go back and be in the classroom and learn some more and still be in higher education, but maybe not student affairs. And so I applied to doctoral programs, got into Michigan State. Their higher ed program is highly ranked, and I'm like, well, I got in. Of course I'm going to go. And, man, it was the best decision. It was just the best decision I ever made. I initially thought I was going to study one thing, but on the side, I was, you know, kind of, I thought I was going to focus on student activism, because when I was at Simmons working there professionally, there were a lot of student activists on campus working to address, you know, things that they were challenged by in the Simmons community, as well as the Boston national and international community. I was just really interested in student activism on college campuses. And so I thought that was what my research focus was. I had started working on that, doing papers for class. But my first year at Michigan State, that January was the one-year anniversary of that tragic earthquake in Haiti. I was doing an event. I was marking the one-year anniversary. I was doing a fundraiser. I was partnering with a local organization in Michigan that actually founded and was running a school and an orphanage in Haiti. They established it right after the earthquake. So I was doing this fundraiser on the behalf of this organization, but also to remind folks that, like, a year later, things were still devastating. And I just had an epiphany. Like, I was setting up, and I was like, wait a minute, I'm Haitian American. I'm studying higher education. I am committed to higher education. I have a love and a passion for Haiti. Why am I not doing something to address higher education needs in Haiti? And in that moment, I dropped my original research area, that my interest in student activism, and it was just all about Haiti after that. And so fast forward to 2015, I was able to go to Haiti twice, the first time ever. During that time, and a lot of my projects were related to Haiti, and I was able to do a case study of the Haitian Education and Leadership Program, which I'll talk more about. And then I wrote a dissertation and defended it, and here I am now. So that's, you know, my educational journey, a little bit about my professional journey, and here we are.
It's like full circle. I'm not surprised you would have. I mean, luckily you sort of switch gear a little early, I hope, because, you know, choosing a topic is really hard, especially when you have a lot of interest, and you could have gone in so many different directions. And, you know, and then even the topic you've chosen, I would have thought, oh, my God, the literature, because it's not one of those things where you study about, you know, school experience, or even I think the activism you would have studied, like there's more information and research on that. And so I didn't even realize you could write in Creole. I was like, what is this? As I was reading.
My parents can't believe it either. Well, you know, I taught Haitian Creole for 2 years at Michigan State, and so I had to learn very quickly how to write Creole. Yeah.
It's almost like you went abroad and learned about your own culture, which is amazing, right there in the U.S. So the official title of
your
dissertation is...
Well, before you say that,
sure.
Can I say something about that comment? So the very first time I went to Haiti was in 2012. So my whole life I heard about Haiti, read about Haiti, saw it on the news. I had this picture kind of that was developed over time based on media and my family accounts and my parents. The last time my dad went to Haiti was 1977, my mom 86. So when I went to Haiti in 2012, I was straight up a stranger by myself without a parent in this country that I loved but never been to before. And so every day I was taking pictures, and then I was emailing them to my dad. And I remember, you know, and there were some key places in Port-au-Prince that my dad knew, right, as well. well as my mom. And so I remember the first night I called my dad, and he was like, Michelle, he was like, your whole life you were seeing Shady through our eyes, but now it's a generation later, and now we're seeing Shady through your eyes. And it was like this most profound moment, right? And so I was showing my dad, you know, the fact that you did mid-scene, and my dad had wanted to go to medical school, and so he was seeing what the medical school looked like in Shamas, you know, right in the center, the city center. And he was like, wow, it's so different from when I was there. And just key places in Port-au-Prince I was showing him, and places that he actually had never even been to before. And he was like, I haven't seen Haiti since 77, and now through you I got to see my country again. And, oh, man, I was like just I was shaken up just by that comment, you know. And so I definitely feel like I came full circle. Yes, I was born and raised in the United States, but I definitely was raised in a close-knit, you know, Haitian community in Cambridge and had a strong, you know, Haitian identity. And so just that first time I went was definitely personal. And then when I went again in 2013, it was definitely for academic reasons, but it actually, I knew my purpose, and it was definitely connected to my upbringing and my identity. So it was a highly personal research experience, is what I'm trying to say.
That's great. No, because again, you know, again, depending on the program that you in, things get very sort of, I don't know, it's sort of, it's not personal. I mean, you study something that either you specialize or you're going to try to get a job in versus something that directly related to your interests or your culture. I mean, that may change again, depending on the school and the program. And so a lot of time, I don't know if anyone really do things that are that close to them, especially when you're thinking of research, you know, in terms of that whole, you can't be biased, you can't be this and all that stuff. So, I mean, I think it's a great choice because there isn't enough being done. I mean, I don't think it's one of those popular topics that, you know, tons of students are studying, which is a shame because there's a huge population. The demographic you study, it's not sort of like this sort of small sample of people. Great choice. Do you want to say what the title of your dissertation is? Would you want to Creole at the beginning?
So it's funny. I feel like I'm being quizzed. I'm like, what is the title of my dissertation again?
This is like your second defense, but it's one-on-one instead of your committee.
Say that one more time.
No, I said this is like your second defense of your dissertation.
Oh, I know.
The committee. It's just the two of us.
Right. So the title of my dissertation is Tête Chargée, which is a Haitian term, as you know, and it's an investigation of the Haitian education leadership program in the higher education landscape in Haiti. Now, Tête Chargée was a term that came up in one of my interviews, and I was interviewing the career and alumni services manager, and she was, you know, talking about a particular experience she would have, you know, related to higher education in Haiti and the work that she did in higher education in Haiti. And she's like, oh, Michelle, c'est une tête chargée. It's a tête chargée. And I was like, oh, my goodness, this is the title of my dissertation.
That's
I don't
it.
Even know how else I'm going to fit it in there, but tête chargée exclamation point will be in my title. And it fit because at that point I was midway through interviews and I had already struggled with putting together a lit review because, as you know, like, there's just not a lot of literature about higher education.
There's nothing.
It's like a lot of deficit thinking, and you have to really reach far and wide to piecemeal things together. And then I was had interviewed, you know, a person from the Ministry of Education and a lot of alumni and students and staff of this program. So by the time I interviewed her, I was like, how am I going to make sense of all this data I collected? And she described it, and she was like, this is a tête chargée. And I'm like, it is. It was like a bird in head, right? It was like all this stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of challenges, and it's like, so how am I going to get to the bottom of it? So that's sort of what Tête Chargée refers to, if you will. And then, of course, I wanted to have the name of the organization I did a case study on. It was very important to me that they were named in the title so that if people do a tour of the organization that they could see that there was research on them. I think they do great stuff. And as much as my dissertation is a reflection of my experience, truly, though, it's a reflection of the work that they do in Haiti, and it's a reflection of the experiences of those I interviewed. And so it's as much theirs as it is my in terms of my work. And so it was very important to me that their name was in my title. So it wasn't highly creative, but I just wanted to be sure that I had Tête Chargée to explain.
And right in the beginning.
To provide some insight on the experience researching higher education in Haiti, as well as, you know, paying homage to the organization that allowed me to come in and be with them for a month. So
that's great. Do you want to tell us what HELP is and stand for, and how you even discover organization?
HELP. Yeah, so HELP stands for the Haitian Education and Leadership Program. You know, they're an organization in Haiti that's been here for quite some time. They had their first student in 1997, and now they've grown to about 130. They work with university students, and so it's highly competitive. Students who participate in their program have to have straight A's and demonstrate the most financial need. And when you consider Haiti's distinction of being, very impoverished, for you to demonstrate the most financial need really kind of describes the type of students that HELP supports. But then if you're accepted, HELP, you know, provides you a full scholarship for all 5 years. So in Haiti, you're in school for 5 years. They provide housing if your family is not from Port-au-Prince. You get a monthly stipend. You have access to academic advisors, a career advisor, an alumni advisor when you graduate from school and HELP. You're required to take 3 enrichment courses, so a leadership course, an ESL course, as well as an IT course or computer science. Students do community projects at the HELP Center in their first year, and then the following 4 years, they do community projects in the Port-au-Prince and Greater Haiti neighborhoods. Students get access to apply for various opportunities abroad. So if they want to do a summer enrichment program or take summer courses at different places, you know, in the U.S. or Montreal, for example, you know, HELP supports the application and helps them translate things into English or the appropriate language. Actually, one of the students I had interviewed for my dissertation, I just learned, is a Fulbright scholar now. So these students are, like, highly successful, highly intelligent. The HELP Center also has an on-site library and a computer lab. And so a lot of the things I describe, like housing and stipends and all that stuff, are things you would find in the U.S., right? Like, you have housing if you want to live on campus. You have access to financial aid. There's a library. There's a computer, you know, there's a computer center, hopefully more than one, at your school. But in Haiti, that's virtually unheard of. You go, if you find the way to, first of all, you have to get into the school, then you have to find tuition somehow, and then you go to school and you come back, and you're not necessarily guaranteed, you know, a desk or a fully functioning classroom or even a teacher on a particular day. I mean, there's some schools that are doing really great things in Haiti, and then there are some institutions that are just really struggling, and so HELP really stands out in terms of the services that they provide for students. And then when you look at their statistics, like 90% of their students graduate from university. 84% of their students graduate from university.
Right, I was looking at your graph.
Yeah. So they're
in comparison to the other programs, yeah.
Right. So that's HELP. And so how I learned about them was really in an interesting way. I'm a member of this organization called the International Association for Student Affairs and Services. And so they put out a call in early 2012 for it was a worldwide call, to be part of an evaluation team to evaluate, you know, the range of programs and services of HELP. And I was like, wait a minute, I work in student affairs. I have an international focus in higher ed. I speak Haitian Creole good enough.
I
know the Haitian
it.
Culture. So I put an application in, like, immediately. But I didn't think I'd get accepted because there's scholars and practitioners who've been in the game for 20, 25, 30 years. Who am I, right? But I thought, why not me? So I put in an application, and, you know, a few weeks went by, then months went by, then more months went by. And then I got an email saying, you've been selected. And I couldn't believe it. So there was a 3-member team, me and another individual who was selected, who works in Montreal. His name is Rich, and he's awesome. And then the president of IASIS at the time, the 3 of us went to Haiti for a week, and that was my very first time in Haiti, and I was intimidated. I was nervous. I was scared. I was unsure. But, you know, as soon as we got down to business and doing our work, I was like, this is what I'm meant to be doing, you know, working on higher education challenges and addressing access and persistence. And, you know, there's a lot of things that people do for Haiti in terms of development and aid, and not a lot of it goes to higher education. And so I'm just really proud of the work that we did in 2012, and I'm, you know, really proud of the work that I did since then.
That's great. I saw there was a lot of translation, even your consent forms, your you know, the letter for IRB approval? Like, was, in addition to Haitian Creole, it seemed like you also had to sort of brush up on your French as well.
Right.
To get
Which
this,
I don't do French
process
at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For now.
So, well, okay, so I still don't speak French well. I will say that my French did get a little better in terms of my comprehension, so I could understand it more.
Yeah.
But I definitely respond in both in French or in Creole. And so it was really interesting because there are times in my interviews where the students were like, oh, I want to interview in English because I want to practice my English. Okay, great. And so then I'd get some question that they didn't understand, and I would try to say it in Creole, but they couldn't understand my accent. And so then I had them read the question because I didn't translate my you know, questions.
Right.
Someone else did them for me. So I'd point to the question, they would read it in French. They're like, oh, okay, my complaint, I understand. And then they would respond in Creole. And so I was working in three languages, even though they couldn't really speak English and I couldn't really speak French. So it was a really interesting research experience for sure.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the data is great. I mean, how has I think there were challenges before the earthquake. I mean, how has things changed afterwards, that program specifically and higher education as a whole?
Yeah, so when I went in 2012,
even 5 years later.
Right. Well, definitely in 2012 when I went, it was like still almost as if it just happened. A lot of the people we met with brought it up without being prompted. You could just see tent cities. You could see rubble. It was just quite visible. And a lot of the health students who were older talked about, you know, where they were when the earthquake happened. A lot of the staff had to move in into the houses that help rent for its students. Two students lost their lives. Many of the students and staff had family members who lost their lives. So it was very palpable. Like, it was like a real live living thing, right? In 2013, it was a little bit different where a lot of the rubble had been cleaned up. The tent cities where folks were still living in weren't as visible. And while it was still part of their experience, students more talked about it, you know, as if, yeah, so you know, since the earthquake, you know, and then X, Y, and Z. But for some students, they were still playing catch up because it really impacted the curriculum. And so in Haiti, it's a little different than U.S., whereas in the U.S., you kind of choose your catalog of courses. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Then you have your degree. Well, in Haiti, for the state school at least, they sort of say in year one, this is what you're going to do. Year two, you're doing this. Year three, you're doing this. So for the earthquake, what happened was when it was time to go back to courses, students had to finish all the courses from the year before and do the ones for the present year at the same time. And so there were students who were taking like 13, 14 classes at one time because the clock didn't stop, right? And so that was a big deal for some students, those who were in the state school. And then, you know, a lot of professionals, a lot of faculty lost their lives, or those who had the means left the country, right? And so the access to faculty was a bit more challenging, and having the professionals or the experts who could teach very specific courses, some of them just weren't there, or they were spending time in Haiti as well as like Miami or other parts of the U.S. So they could only take classes when the faculty member was in town. So the earthquake still had an impact in that way. And I think that though the earthquake also uncovered a lot of deficiencies in the system in terms of the ministry not necessarily knowing like all the different institutions that are in the country. So of course it's aware of the accredited institutions in the capital, as well as the state university system. But there are a lot of other organizations that just come up, build a building, or put a sign on the building and say we're in college or your university,
right,
without necessarily being accredited. So the earthquake kind of revealed a lot of things that needed to be attended to that they probably didn't notice or didn't put a lot of focus on before. And I think one of the big things that a lot of folks realize is how underfunded the higher education system is, and the need for higher education to be funded and addressed if you want the country to kind of grow and take part of the international knowledge community. It's important, right? So one of the quotes that stand out to me from my dissertation is like, you know, funding primary and secondary is great, but you can't run a country on a high school education, right? So if you don't invest in higher education in Haiti or other countries for that matter, then really what's going to happen eventually, there's going to be needs that go unmet, and it's going to, what's going to happen is what is already happening in Haiti, whereas Haiti is dependent on a lot of foreign and international aid as opposed to being self-sufficient. And I think it's enough of that, right? It's time for Haiti to be able to kind of take back some of its authority, I think, at least, in my humble opinion, and really address the needs of its country on its own. I'm not saying give up on help. There's capacity within the country that needs to be developed, and I think higher education is a way to do it.
To get that done. I mean, and again, you know, you have resources there, and so a lot of time you may lose the population that's educated. They may go elsewhere, like Miami or Canada or other part of the world, and not remain in Haiti because of lack of opportunities and resources. So speaking of opportunities, what are your plans?
What
are your plans now that you reached the big goal of getting the degree, which was probably a huge challenge in itself? So what are you looking for now in terms of what's your ideal dream job post getting that doctorate?
Oh gosh, it's really challenging because I know that I'm definitely interested in where higher education and international development comes together. And so I would love to work for an organization that's addressing higher education needs in low-income and developing countries like Haiti, whether as a regional director, so like the Caribbean as a region, for example. Or I wouldn't mind working for a research or policy organization that's addressing those challenges. I wouldn't mind being a faculty member in like international higher education, where I'm, you know, conducting research and perhaps being a consultant working on those issues. So my interests are really broad. I know higher education. I know in low income developing countries, but what specifically I want to do, you know. It could be anything. So the Clinton Foundation, for example, does address educational needs, but not necessarily higher education. So organizations like the Clinton Foundation, if they were to have a higher education branch or an education branch that includes higher education, that is something I'd be interested in. So I don't know.
Yeah, because I think a lot of time, I mean, higher education is typically sort of removed because when you think of Haiti, typically it's still talked about as one of the country with the highest illiteracy rate in the world, and so I don't think people really think about higher education. I mean, I think they're focused on sort of like the most basic in terms of people learning just to read as like a basic. But at the same time, I mean, you have another group where that gap needs to be met. So I think those organizations, you will be a great resource in terms of showing how they can address that need that they may not see as an urgent need when you're dealing with rebuilding and post sort of disaster relief kind of work that's going on right now. So there's a lot to be done, but I wanted to move away from your dissertation. I know even though you've been sort of deep in academic work, you managed to sort of do some other reading. Your references are just really extensive. And so I wanted to move away from the academic stuff and see, have you been reading anything that might still be of interest to you, but that's less rigorous than sort of this whole scholarly work? What have you been reading just for leisure and fun?
Just for leisure. Oh, okay. So I was able to read some other stuff. I did manage some non-academic reading.
Yes.
In fact, I needed to, because my brain needed a mental break. So I love to read. It's been a lifelong passion. So I read a few books recently. One of them is Purple Hibiscus by Chimamanda Adichie, who is a Nigerian author, and I think a lot of people probably know who she is. She did a TED Talk a while back. Clearly See Light by Edwige Nanticoat, who's my favorite author. She's a Haitian-American author. And Clear to See Light is her most recent novel. And actually, my friend got it for me as a present because Edwige Nanticoat had went to her school to talk, and so she got that book. Yeah, and then so there's other books. I was in an airport in New Orleans, and I came across a bookstore in the airport that was like fantastic. I bought like 5 books. I wanted to buy 10, but I only bought 5.
Oh my
and one
God.
Of them I bought what's called The Book of Night Woman by Marlon James. I've never heard of this author before, and I hadn't heard about this book before, but it was so good. It was a novel where the setting is Jamaica, specifically around
slavery
times. What did you say?
No, I said you have your list is very diverse.
Yeah, it is.
And you're
the
author. And,
yeah. I don't know. I love books that are rich and have great storytelling and a lot of detail and layered and not necessarily U.S.-centric, and these three books are not.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just really good.
Definitely.
Good read. So I need to find some more books.
We have heard of Marlon James. I know he's also an author of color, and that's one thing people talk a lot about in terms of having really sort of diverse writers and getting those stories that are not necessarily sort of, domestic or reflect sort of characters from other places. And in an interesting way, I think it does tie with your dissertation in a way, because a lot of time the population you're studying, you don't see them in sort of academic work, but you also don't see them in sort of literature that sort of, you know, diverse population is reading, but they may not see themselves in those texts. Just like when you're reading a dissertation or doing research, there's so many groups that are missing from those line of work. So I'm sure you read more than three books, but those are great choices. So I'm going to include that on my profile. And so if people want to read them, I started reading Claire of the Sea Light. I didn't finish it. It's one of those things. It's not like a traditional sort of stories where you start from beginning to end. There's a lot of sort of back and forth in terms of sharing histories and so many different things, and it's really interesting. And it's one of those things, I don't know if I can sit and read it through all the way.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Yeah, I feel that way, but The Book of Night Woman is another one where, I mean, there's some tough scenes in there and tough topics and things where it was a great, well-written book, but I definitely had to, like, put it down, walk away from it, think about it, come back, you know, in a couple of days, so... I'd love authors who would get me to really kind of get in there. So even though it's for leisure, it definitely got me stimulated intellectually, absolutely.
Yeah, those are great. And then I was going to ask you about music stuff, but then I thought, you know, because I tried to put, so at the beginning of the show, I play a little bit of Bookman Experience as a way to sort of warm up. It's hard to choose depending on the guest. Like, I'll try to sort of pick musician. I mean, they're not necessarily sort of your mainstream sort of music that people, I mean, it's roots music. So a lot of time they're not necessarily from like one country or specifically, but I was trying to find something like, what does Michelle listen to when she's not like doing her sort of serious work? So that's the best I could come up with.
No, that was actually really good. I don't even know if I could answer that question, because it definitely got to a point where I was like, I put a Pandora station on low so I could write but not actually get distracted by the music. So I need to kind of get reacquainted with music again.
Acquainted with
actually.
The music world, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, no, there are so many. And so, yeah, so I was trying to look and see. I'm not in the loop. I mean, I listen to all kind of music, and luckily, thank God for YouTube and all these other pages where people can sort of bring stuff out and kind of share. So those are great. So we are sort of down to the final minutes of the show. Any final words to our listeners? Any plan to turn the dissertation into a book, an article, or something for, you know, regular folks who are not necessarily want to read 300 pages of of a book?
Wait, they don't want to read a 300-page dissertation?
No.
I actually am working on an article right now where I'm kind of taking HELP's approach, and I'm analyzing whether they can be a model, or how they work as students, how they can be a model in other low-income countries. Language was something that came up, the fact that Haitian Creole, French and English is sort of used a lot in Haiti in the classroom as well as professionally. And so I'm looking at language and the role it plays, as well as some other findings that came out. So I'm definitely working on some articles on my dissertation. And then broadly speaking, I'm interested in issues of university access and persistence, you know, not just in Haiti, but in areas where students are underrepresented. So that's another focus for me that I'll be working on.
One thing I meant to ask you, were there any gender differences in terms of the students in the HELP program? Was it pretty balanced in terms of male,
they try to keep it. Oh, they try to keep it about 50-50. Unfortunately, because of gender balance in education broadly in Haiti, it's not always easy, but they try to, and they do some very specific initiatives to ensure as much of an equal balance as possible.
Yeah, because I mean, I think in the U.S., it's really interesting. Like in the last few months alone, sort of most of the students that I know, sort of whether they're getting master's or PhDs, have been primarily women, especially in the U.S. So I don't know if you notice that trend in terms of if you see a lot of sort of male students that are pursuing higher education, whether in the Caribbean or in Haiti, when you were doing, or in the U.S., when you were doing your literature review?
Well, in Haiti, I would say broadly, yes, that the persistence rate for men is higher. But I think there's a lot of cultural reasons for that, too. You know, some of the staff mentioned this in my visit in 2012 about, you know, if you don't live in the capital, sometimes you have to walk back and forth. And so there's safety issues, unfortunately, and cultural reasons. There's a lot of time where girls are like, or young women are asked to stay home and help to take care of the family or support the family in that way. But I will say that HELP recognizes that as a cultural phenomenon. And so they really strive to have as much as possible a 50-50% in terms of the students that they admit each year. When you look at the staff at HELP, the majority are women, and they do a lot of community work with local organizations that are run by women. So they definitely want to kind of change the perception of women in society, and they do you know, really well in the organization.
That's great. So I want to thank you for being on the show finally. I'm hoping you'll come back. I'm sure we have much more to talk about.
Absolutely.
And
thank you for having me.
Keep me posted. And, of course, you can always recommend others who should be on the program. So I want to thank everyone for listening. If you are interested in getting more information about Michelle's work, feel free to find me on Twitter or Pinterest or on Facebook. Thank God Michelle is doing Facebook now. And so we'll follow up on that. Again, thank you, everybody, for listening. We're going to go back to a little music, and I'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.